Chapter 4.
Good evening. I'm Roger Stevens, and here is tonight's news. The search for Donovan Steele continues as police and federal marshals stepped up their hunt today for the renegade cyborg accused of killing 4 Strike Force officers in an ambush yesterday, and also of the murder of 8 federal marshals earlier this week. So far, the police seem to have no leads as to his whereabouts, but today, News 4 has learned of some startling new developments in this story. For details, we go to Rob Summers. Roger, I'm standing here on Perry Street with someone I'm sure many of our viewers will recognize, reporter Linda Tellerman of Eyewitness News. Linda called me earlier today with a story that, quite frankly, knocked my socks off. Linda, suppose you tell our viewers what you told me this morning.
I'd be glad to, Rob. On Wednesday afternoon, I was in the Channel 7 newsroom when I received a call from Donovan Steele. He claimed that he had been framed and wanted to tell his side of the story. The only condition he set for the interview was that I was to come alone, with only my cameraman, and that I was not to tell anyone where I was going. If I brought the police or let myself be followed, all bets were off.
Linda, having covered the story of what happened when the cyborg known as Stalker ran amok, weren't you apprehensive for your own safety?
Summers asked.
To be perfectly honest, Rob, I was not without some apprehension.
Linda replied.
But as a reporter, it's my job to take risks when necessary. However, when I spoke to Steele, he seemed perfectly rational. He was not threatening, and he certainly did not seem insane. And the story that he told me was frankly astonishing. While his friend, Raven, remained in the background keeping watch with an assault rifle, Steele told me the story of his malfunctioning and running amok has been entirely fabricated and engineered by none other than Senator Bryce Carman.
That seems hard to believe,
said Summers.
What possible reason would a man of Senator Carman's reputation have for doing such a thing?
According to Steele, the reasons were political. Senator Carman has always been against the idea of cyborgs and in favor of disbanding the CIA. Senator Carman has himself confirmed that in public statements on numerous occasions. In fact, the senator had previously succeeded in influencing Congress to cut the agency's operating budget and shut it down, but the legislator changed its mind due to popular support for Steele and the agency after they aborted General Cord's attempt to stage a military coup. Steele claims that the senator was not about to be deterred and that he saw his chance to proceed with his plans when Dr. Jennifer Stone, chief engineer for Project Download, came to Senator Carman with allegations of security violations and an attendant cover-up at the project. According to Steele, her actions were motivated by personal animosity. She further alleged that Steele had not responded when ordered to report in to Project Headquarters and was apparently malfunctioning.
Yet when you met Steele, you said you observed no signs of any malfunction,
Summers said.
None whatsoever. Steele admitted to me that he had failed to report in when ordered, but claimed it was because he was pursuing an investigation and could not afford to drop it at that time. His first indication that anything was wrong occurred when he came home and found a team of heavily armed federal marshals waiting to arrest him.
What reason did he give for having resisted arrest?
Summers asked.
He claimed that he did not resist at first,
said Linda.
He thought it was some sort of misunderstanding and asked to make a phone call to Oliver Higgins, director of the project, in hopes of clearing the situation up. However, he was then told that Higgins was also a fugitive, along with Dr. Devin Cooper. About that same time, he saw another man that the marshals had taken into custody, a CIA agent by the name of Randall Sharp. Sharp, claimed Steele, had been brutalized by the marshals, and when Steele saw him, Sharp immediately urged him to escape.
So Steele broke away from the marshals, killing 5 of them in the process?
Summers said.
No, he claims he didn't. That is, he broke away from the marshals, but he denies killing any of them. There is apparently some support for this claim. Several witnesses at the scene reported that those 5 marshals were killed by gunfire coming from a gypsy cab that helped Steele escape, although those reports have been disputed by the authorities. I asked him about that, and Steele replied that those marshals had been shot by ICE, his partner, and the driver of the gypsy cab, a man known as Slim, who had assisted Steele on several cases in the past. Steele said he wasn't trying to justify what they had done, but stated that they had seen him being shot at and were under fire themselves, so they reacted accordingly.
If that's true, and the whole thing was a tragic misunderstanding,
Summers said,
then why didn't Steele turn himself in and clear it up?
because he claims that he subsequently learned from Oliver Higgins, who had taken shelter at the Borodini enclave on the island, that both the police and the federal marshals had orders to shoot him on sight. Higgins apparently believed that if Steele tried to turn himself in, Senator Carman would see to it that he was placed on downtime and dismantled, so he wouldn't be able to prove that he was not malfunctioning. In spite of this, Steele claims that both he and Dr. Cooper wanted to come back to Midtown and tell their side of the story, but the enclave was raided by federal marshals before they could do so. Why didn't they surrender themselves to the federal marshals then?
Asked Summers.
Steele claims that they did. That is, he claims that Higgins gave him orders not to allow himself to be taken, but that Higgins, Cooper, and the others all surrendered. Steele claims that Higgins ordered his men not to fire at the marshals under any circumstances.
Yet there was a protracted firefight during that raid,
Summers said.
How did Steele account for that?
He claims the firefight with the agents in the mansion was staged by the marshals for the benefit of the news cameras. Steele believes that Higgins, Cooper, and the others were all executed after they'd surrendered on the orders of Senator Carman.
That's an astonishing allegation,
Summers said.
That was exactly what I told him,
Linda replied.
I asked him if he had any proof to back it up. He admitted that he didn't. He also admitted to stealing a helicopter in order to escape and using it to shoot down another chopper that tried to get pursuit.
That would account for three of the deaths he's charged with,
Summers said.
The crew of that helicopter.
That's correct,
said Linda.
He freely admitted to that, but he claimed he had no other choice. He said the pursuing helicopter fired on him and the ice was fatally wounded in the exchange.
In other words, he's claiming it was self-defense,
asked Summers.
That's correct. However, he also said that he realizes his allegations are meaningless without proof. He said he would get that proof. He concluded the interview by saying, and I quote, "The only person I'm a threat to is Bryce Carman." And then, addressing himself directly to the senator, he turned to the camera and said, "I'm going to get the goods on you, you bastard. I'm going to see you go to jail for what you've done."
You say that concluded the interview,
said Summers.
But that interview was never aired. Why is that?
It was pulled,
Linda replied.
Seized by federal marshals. I did not go on the air that night. I was actually threatened by the marshals, told that if I tried to go on the air with what I'd learned, I'd be placed under arrest.
What happened to that interview?
I had to resort to legal means to get it back, but by the time it was returned, it had been erased. They claimed it was a mistake, but I'm convinced it was erased on purpose. I received no support whatsoever from the station management at Channel 7. I was told they were being pressured by the owners.
One of whom is Senator Bryce Carman?
One of whom is Senator Bryce Carman.
What was your reaction to that?
I was outraged at such a blatant attempt to suppress the news, and I was frankly inclined to think that there could be some truth to Steele's allegations.
And what are your feelings now after what happened last night, when those four officers were killed?
Asked Summers.
When I learned about the deaths of those four officers, I began to question the whole thing,
she replied.
I started to wonder if Steele's story wasn't merely a paranoid delusion, the result of a malfunction of his computer brain. To repeat, I had seen no evidence of any instability on his part, but those officers allegedly identified him before they died.
You say allegedly. Why is that?
Asked Summers.
Because this morning, I received a call from a woman who claims that Steele couldn't have murdered those officers because he was with her all night.
And that's the woman we're about to speak to. Who lives in the building directly behind us.
That's correct.
We'll get her story in a moment,
Summers said.
But first, let me ask you, why didn't you interview the witness yourself? You came to us, the competition, with his exclusive story. Why?
Because I was being silenced at Channel 7,
Linda said,
victimized by political pressure, and I wanted to make sure that this story got out. The people of this city have a right to know.
They then interviewed Donna Barrett, who testified on camera that Steele and Raven had been staying with her and that they had been with her at the time the shootings occurred. In response to their questions, she stated that she was not afraid of being charged with aiding and abetting fugitives because she knew them to be innocent and felt that after all Steele had done for the people of the city, someone owed him a chance to state his case and prove his innocence. Summers then gave it back to Roger Stevens in the studio, and Stevens appeared on camera with Linda sitting next to him.
An amazing story, Linda,
Stevens said to her.
And one that certainly seems to cast some serious doubt on the allegations against Steele.
True,
she replied.
However, we still have the reports of those slain officers, which conflict with Miss Barrett's contention that Steele was with her at the time. And Steele did admit to shooting down that helicopter during the raid on the Enclave, which amounts to a confession that he killed the crew, consisting of 3 federal marshals. Whether he was forced to do it or not is not the issue. The fact is that he admitted to doing it.
So that's something that's going to have to be settled in court,
said Stevens.
Whether or not it was justifiable under the circumstances.
Ordinarily, that would be the case,
Linda replied.
But this is an extraordinary situation. Technically, since Steele's brain is a computer, the law regards him as a machine, not as a human being. So in essence, he has no civil rights. Even if he were to turn himself in at this point, there would be nothing to prevent the authorities from having him dismantled, as he put it. Effectively, they'd be free to execute him without a trial.
Stevens shook his head.
An incredible story,
he said.
Both complex and highly controversial.
Extremely controversial,
Linda agreed.
And it certainly raises a lot of questions. I tried to get Senator Carman's reaction to all this, but the senator could not be reached for comment.
Interesting,
Stevens said.
Incidentally, I should point out for the benefit of our viewers that after the management of Channel 7 found out you did this report, you were fired.
That's true, Roger. I was. However, News 4 immediately offered me a job, and I will continue to pursue this story until the full truth is revealed. As I said earlier, the people have a right to know.
They do indeed,
said Stevens.
We're proud to have you with us. Welcome to the team.
Senator Bryce Carman was at home, watching the evening news, when the phone rang. He answered it irritably.
Good evening, Bryce. Have you heard the news tonight?
Carman immediately dropped his irritable tone. Yes, I just saw the report. He'd been tipped off by the Channel 7 management that Linda Tellerman had done a report for Channel 4 and joined their staff. The idiots had fired her. What they should have done was sue her for breach of contract when she appeared on a rival station. Then she could have been enjoined from appearing on the air until the case was settled. But it was too late to do anything about that now.
We were under the impression that you had the situation well in hand,
the caller said. Nothing's changed, said Carman. That Tellerman woman is simply grandstanding.
It appeared to be rather effective grandstanding.
Sensational journalism, nothing more, Carman replied. All they're doing is throwing around wild allegations. They can't prove anything.
Do you think it was wise of you not to respond to those wild allegations, Bryce?
I didn't see the point in dignifying them with a response.
Or perhaps you couldn't think of one. When a politician cannot be reached for comment, it tends to give the impression that he is ducking the issue.
You think I should make some sort of statement?
Perhaps it would be wise. A press conference would seem appropriate, given your telegenic talents. It would be ever so much more effective than a simple statement released through your office. Don't you think?
Carman frowned. Very well. I'll call a press conference for noon tomorrow.
Good. This sort of thing needs to be stopped quickly before it has a chance to build up its own momentum.
I don't think there's much chance of that, Carman replied. Strikeforce has their blood up. Steele killed 4 of their own.
He was one of their own,
the caller reminded him.
A large percentage of them staged a sick-out rather than go out and hunt him down. There is a great deal of loyalty there for a former comrade. At present, they appear to be convinced he's gone out of control and embarked upon a murderous rampage. But give them an opportunity for doubt, and they might seize upon it.
They're not going to doubt the words of their fellow officers, said Carman. That Barrett's woman's testimony doesn't mean a thing. She cannot prove that Steele was with her at the time. It's her word against the word of 4 Strike Force officers who bravely gave their lives in the line of duty.
Perhaps,
the caller said.
But the sooner this Steele affair is settled once and for all, the better. It's becoming an annoyance. The significant thing is Project Download. And while we're on that subject, there's the question of Dr. Stone.
What about her?
She has become a liability. she turned on Oliver Higgins, she could just as easily turn on you.
She wouldn't dare! She knows her future's entirely in my hands.
She knows entirely too much. There seems to be some concern, Bryce, that you might be becoming, how shall I put it, sloppy?
I told you that I'm in control.
I hope so, Bryce. We'd like to see some evidence of that, and we'd like to see it very soon. Good night, Bryce.
The phone went dead. Carmen softly hung up the receiver. He did not care for this. He did not care for this at all. They were obviously displeased with him. He hated to be reminded of his subordinate position to them. It made him furious. He liked to think that he was the one in control. He didn't mind doing things for them, guiding certain legislation, exerting pressure on local politicians, because that meant exercising control over others, and always gave him a feeling of satisfaction. But he did not like being made to think that he was the one being controlled. He might not mind cooperating with them, but he hated being told what to do. The only trouble was, they were a great deal more powerful than he was. They wanted Jennifer Stone out of the way. That did not surprise him. He should have expected it. Jennifer Stone and Steele were the only wild cards left in the scenario. No, not quite. There was a third wild card, the Matrix. He had not told them about the Matrix. He knew that would alarm them. The Matrix could be dangerous, potentially even more dangerous than Steele, but the Matrix could also be very useful if he could find a way to control it. But the key to that was Jennifer Stone. Jennifer despised the Matrix and was obsessed with finding a way to destroy it, so much so that she had delegated all her work at Project Download and was concentrating on nothing else. The Matrix had invaded her privacy and humiliated her. He had humiliated her as well, but he had been smart enough to know to do it in private, where only the two of them would know. Not that she would forgive him for it. They were quite right. She had turned on Higgins, and given half a chance, she'd turn on him as well. But not so long as she needed him. Without him, she would not maintain her position as director of the project, and she would not be able to use that position to find a way to destroy the Matrix. He wanted her to find it. He was convinced that if anybody could, she would. She was a brilliant cybernetics engineer at the very top of her field. She was ambitious, and she was driven. But if, he corrected himself, when she found a way to destroy the Matrix, he would not allow her to do it. By that time, Steele would certainly be found and taken out of action. Without Steele, the Matrix would be a lot more vulnerable. He'd be able to use the means of destroying it as a threat to make the Matrix work for him. If Jennifer were willing to cooperate, so much the better. But he had a feeling that she wouldn't. She wanted the Matrix destroyed and would stop at nothing to accomplish it. So at that point, it would be necessary to get her out of the way. But they wanted her out of the way now. She made them nervous. That was inconvenient. He needed her for a while longer. He would have to stall. The sooner Steele could be getting rid of, the better. That would satisfy them for a while. It would buy him time. Time for Jennifer to do what he needed her to do. And after that, she would become superfluous. The only trouble was the media would now be focusing upon her as a result of that Tellerman woman's story. That reporter was a fly in the ointment. He needed Jennifer. He did not need Linda Tellerman. He reached the phone again and dialed.
John! Bryce Carmen! I need to schedule a meeting with our mutual friend tomorrow. The usual arrangements. Right. Thank you.
He hung up the phone. Steele and Raven left Rolf Gianelli's place soon after it got dark. They didn't have to worry about being spotted by any of the neighbors. There was no power in the building, and so the hallways were plunged into darkness. After night fell, the people who lived in No Man's Land remained behind their barricaded doors if they knew what was good for them. Only those who were truly desperate, or those who were the predators, ventured out at night.
Okay, the first thing we have to do is to get to a public phone, said Steele. I need to get in touch with the Matrix. That means going back across the border into Midtown. Then we'll need to get out of the city.
We'll have to steal a chopper then.
No, that would be too risky. And it would give the whole thing away. They'd get choppers in the air after us immediately. We'll need a car.
Drive all the way out to the east end of Long Island? At night?
It's the only way.
She exhaled heavily.
What the hell? I'm game if you are.
You don't have to do this. You could still...
Forget it. I'm not staying behind. Besides, by now, they probably got orders to arrest me, too. I've been to jail before. It's not a place I like to visit.
He nodded.
Okay, let's go then. Keep your eyes open.
They headed north toward Midtown, keeping to the shadows. They both carried their weapons openly, as much to discourage trouble as to have them ready in case they needed them. Several times they had to duck out of sight of armored strike force cruisers driving slowly down the streets and playing their searchlights all around them. Steele knew they wouldn't give him a chance to explain if they spotted him. He knew how cops felt about cop killers. They moved quickly, heading back toward Midtown. It was like walking through a war zone. Firelight flickered in the ruined buildings and inside abandoned storefronts. Shadows moved. Occasionally, some started to come toward them, but hesitated when they saw the guns. Steele knew. Might be desperate enough not to hesitate. They might try for the guns. A bullet could come from out of nowhere. They could run into well-armed gang members and get into a firefight. And that would be certain to draw the strike force units down on them. Steele could not afford that. He felt like a criminal, skulking through the darkness. He was a criminal. And a murderer. He had killed the crew of that helicopter at the Enclave. Yet, he didn't feel like a murderer. He was only trying to survive. He knew the law wouldn't see it that way, though. As they moved through the darkness, running across the streets and taking cover where they could, he thought about how radically his life had changed. It didn't seem so long ago they had been cruising these streets in an armored strike force unit, just like his old colleagues on the force, who were now hunting him. He never would have imagined that he could find himself in such a situation. He kept thinking about those four strike force cops who died. He couldn't understand it. What had really happened? He hadn't known Steve Jernigan, but he'd met Passarelli. Young, a rookie who'd come onto the force not long ago. Jernigan had transferred in from Metro. They'd given brief biographies of the slain men on the news. Jernigan had a wife and three kids. Marshak had been married, too. And Coblins. He had known George Coblins. George had a wife and two teenage daughters. Why would they say that it was him? It made no sense. Why would they lie? He could easily see how the marshals could have been corrupted. They were essentially soldiers, grunts, and nothing more. And more of them were the dregs of the military. Given the drastic shortage of military manpower, the army needed all the good men it could get to protect the agro-communes and supply convoys, as well as to pacify outlying areas. The people they could spare for duty in the urban centers as federal marshals were people they weren't all that anxious to have in the first place. Generally speaking, federal marshals didn't have all that much to do. Their duties were essentially to act as security guards for federal installations and occasionally to back up local law enforcement agencies. However, most law enforcement agencies didn't want much to do with them. Their training was limited, at best, and just making it through boot camp did not qualify one to be a police officer. Moreover, they were often troublemakers, roughnecks who were a little better, and sometimes a lot worse, than the bully boys who worked for the private security sector. There had been trouble with the marshals before, when they'd gotten out of hand, incidents that had been downplayed. Considering Carmen's wealth and influence, Steele could easily see how a group of them could be subverted. They didn't make much money to begin with, and a charismatic politician like Carmen would have little trouble convincing them that they were acting for the greater good. General Cord had managed to pull off much the same sort of thing with some of the finest units in the military. Carmen would have no difficulty doing it with the thugs who filled out the ranks of the federal marshals. But not with cops. Not with strike force officers. Steele simply couldn't bring himself to believe that Carmen could have gotten to them. He did not believe that men like Dave Marshak and George Coblins could be bought. Then what was the explanation? Jernigan had made the initial report. Could Jernigan have been corrupted? But then that would mean that Passarelli would have been on it as well. Possible, perhaps. But Steele thought it was highly unlikely. Could Jernigan have killed Passarelli himself and then made a false report? No, that was ridiculous. Ballistics would prove that the bullets had been fired from Jernigan's gun. And besides, Jernigan had died himself. Not only that, but Marshak or Coblins, one of the men in the other unit, had confirmed that it was him. But it hadn't been him. So either they had all lied, or they had seen someone they thought was him. Yet that seemed unlikely, too. He didn't know about Jernigan or Passarelli, but Marshak and Coblins had both been veteran officers. They wouldn't have reported a positive identification unless it had been positive. And it obviously couldn't have been. There seemed to be no satisfactory answer, but someone had killed those men. Someone who wanted to look like he had done it. Clearly, it couldn't have been Carmen himself. But it must have been done on his orders. Either that, or someone had taken advantage of the situation to frame him for four more killings. someone who wanted to make sure that Strikeforce would no longer have any doubts about his being a psychotic killer. Steele had plenty of enemies, but it kept coming back to Carmen. He couldn't imagine that any of the gangs could have pulled off something like that. Steele could not figure out how it had been done, but it had been done effectively, efficiently, and professionally. He kept running it over and over in his mind, his computer brain sorting through every possible scenario at lightning speed. He could not come up with any motive for Jernigan and the others to have lied. He had not known Jernigan, and he barely knew Passarelli, but both Markshack and Coblins had been honest cops, and neither of them had been stupid. No matter how he looked at it, nothing made sense. There was no explanation, but there had to be one somewhere.
Steele, watch it!
He snapped out of it as Raven pulled him back into a doorway just as a Strike Force unit came cruising down the street. They flattened out against the wall as the searchlight played past them, and the cruiser continued down the street. Thanks, said Steele.
You okay?
Asked Raven.
Yeah.
You're thinking about those four cops who got killed, aren't you?
She said. He nodded.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure it out, but I keep drawing a blank. Why would they say that it was me? No matter which way I look at it, it just doesn't add up.
Then put it out of your mind and concentrate on one thing at a time,
she said.
We're about a block away from the border. That means we should be able to find a phone soon.
The first two they found were broken, the receivers torn out of the phones. The third one worked. It was on a corner near a steel-shuttered newsstand. Raven kept watch while Steele broke into the coin box and got the change to make the call. It was late, and the streets were deserted. He felt conspicuous as hell. He dialed the access number Matrix had given him.
Steele, where have you been? I was worried that something might have happened,
Matrix said. And once again, Steele had that strange, uneasy feeling at hearing the sound of his own voice on the other end of the line.
We've been hiding out with a friend in no man's land, he said. There wasn't any phone. You know what's been happening?
It felt surreal talking to himself.
I've been monitoring the news reports, and the call's coming in to the police dispatcher,
Matrix said.
Wait a minute! You've been monitoring the dispatcher? Did you happen to hear the calls made by Jernigan and the others?
Yes, I heard them. And I couldn't believe what I heard.
It wasn't me, Matrix. I swear to God it wasn't.
What am I doing, he thought. Trying to convince myself?
I know. The calls were faked.
What? What do you mean they were faked? How?
I don't know exactly how, but I ran a voice print analysis on them. The call was made by Unit 12, and the call made by Unit 21 were both made by the same man, altering his voice slightly. Heard over the radio, with the gunfire in the background, and shouted the way he was, it would have been difficult to recognize the voice. But I matched my analysis with my memories of the voices of both Dave Marshak and George Coblins. Didn't match.
God damn, said Steele. You're absolutely sure.
There's no doubt about it. I ran through all the voices in my memory, but couldn't find a match for the caller. Either it's someone we never knew, or it was someone you met after we were separated. We need to compare notes, but there's a much faster way of doing this.
You mean a download? Steele said.
Not just a download,
Matrix said.
A simultaneous interface. I can give you everything I know over the phone line, while you access your broadcast capability and give me a high-speed signal over the line at the same time.
I should have thought of that, said Steele. But I guess I'm still trying to get used to this whole thing of being separated into two identities. You're right. It would be much faster that way. And I haven't got a lot of time. All right. Let's do it.
He accessed his broadcast link and sent a ultra-high frequency signal over the phone line while the Matrix gave him a high-speed download at the same time. It took less than a minute, but he was not prepared for the effect. It was like sharing consciousness with a separate version of himself. As they interfaced, they truly became one. It was a profound experience. Up to a certain point, Steele and the Matrix had been identical, one and the same. After he had been gunned down by Victor Borodini's assassins, Steele's damaged brain had been accessed through the biochip implanted in his cerebral cortex, and his personality had been downloaded into a computer. It had then been debugged and augmented with ancillary engram data prior to being loaded into his cybernetic brain. They had kept a backup. The Matrix was that backup. It was him, his personality, his soul reduced to software, up to the point that he came online as a cyborg. After that, however, the two of them had experienced very different realities. Steele woke up in a cyborg body with a computer brain. That had taken a great deal of adjustment. In some respects, he was still not entirely adjusted to it. and he wasn't certain if he ever would be. Waking up to find out that your brain had been removed and replaced with a computer was one hell of a shock. But how could it compare to waking up and finding out that you had no body whatsoever, that you were nothing but an engram matrix booted up in a computer? That was what it had been like for Matrix when Dev Cooper had brought it online. As they interfaced, they each shared the other's experiences since their separation from one persona into two. Matrix was finally able to establish that contact it had longed for so desperately, to complete itself and feel reunited with that which it had lost. Through its interface with Steel, it had experienced what it was like to wake up after being in a coma and discover that he, had become a cyborg, part man and part machine, with a computer for a brain. Matrix had experienced the feel of Steel's reconstructed body, the power of the Ni-Steel alloy prosthetics, the capabilities of the built-in weapon systems slaved to Steel's cybernetic brain. It, or he, experienced all of Steel's doubts and fears about his own humanity, and through the interface, it felt what it was like to be a cyborg. Their shared knowledge gave Matrix the experience of knowing Dr. Susan Carmody, of having loved her, and of having lost her when she was murdered in an attempt on Steel's life. Through the interface, Matrix experienced Steel's brief reunion with Janice, their ex-wife, and with their teenage son, Jason. It experienced what Steel had gone through when their daughter, Corey, died. It learned how their partner, Mick Taylor, had not died after all, but had been reconstructed as the first cyborg in the military Stalker series. How he had gone insane and run amok on a murderous rampage until Steel had finally defeated him in a brutal hand-to-hand combat. Matrix experienced Steel's meeting with Ice, and how they had become friends and partners. The interface gave Matrix an intimate knowledge of Raven, of how Steel met and fell in love with her. Everything that had happened to Steel since he awoke as a cyborg became a part of Matrix. And in turn, everything that Matrix had experienced since becoming self-aware became a part of Steel. Through the interface, Steel realized what it was like to exist as pure intelligence, as software without a body. He experienced the frightening sensation of having no sensation, no sense of sight or smell or touch. Matrix had not been able to hear or speak unless hooked up to audio peripherals. Matrix had not been able to see unless connected to a camera. Matrix had not been able to physically feel anything at all, but Steel shared what his electronic clone had felt emotionally, the terror and the anguish of realizing the truth about its own existence. And then Steel shared the experience of Matrix growing to accept what they had become. He discovered the glorious sensation of electronic flight, the ability the Matrix had to travel through the electronic net with the speed of light. He learned of a new form of existence in a new world, a world of intricate electronic mazes that opened up before him as he traveled through it, unfettered by a body, realizing a unique sense of freedom and power. After the interface was complete, they were no longer separate. They were once again one and the same. A man split into two selves that had been reunited. They remained different, yet identical. And Steel found that he could no longer think of the Matrix as being an entity apart from himself. Matrix was no longer an it. Nor could he think of Matrix as a he. The operative word was I. Steel was Matrix, and Matrix was Steel. As a concept, it was difficult to grasp, but as a feeling, it was beyond question. A man who was philosophically inclined might have thought of it in spiritual terms, like a body and an anima that were separate and yet together. If he were mystical, Steel might have thought that he had become like some sort of shaman whose physical body could remain in one location while he freed his astral self to travel to distant points on some spiritual plane. However, Steel was none of these things. He was a simple man, down to earth, with no pretensions of philosophy or mysticism. He simply accepted it because it was. Even if it did conflict with everything that he had ever felt or understood about reality, it was, nevertheless, real and a part of his unique experience. It shook him and it moved him, both. For a moment after the interface had been completed, he felt dazed, unfocused. He was now, quite literally, a man who could be in two places at the same time.
Steel?
Said Raven, looking at him with concern.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine, he said, hanging up the phone. I think.
What happened just now? You looked so strange. What did the Matrix say?
He shook his head.
It's too complicated to explain right now, he said. And I'm not even sure I could explain it. We fused. Sort of.
He moistened his lips.
But the important thing is that now I know what happened to those four cops.
You know who killed them? How?
I'll explain later, he said. Come on, we've got to get moving. It just become a brand new ball game.
Matrix had not been able to find a match for that voice print from the police calls because Matrix had never before heard the voice that made the call. But Steel had. Matrix hadn't known it because Steel had never heard that voice before he became a cyborg. But he'd heard it since. With the voice print he'd received from Matrix, his computer brain ran a high-speed scan of all the voices in his memory, and it found a match. It hadn't been Steve Jernigan. It hadn't been Dave Marshak or George Coblins. He remembered that voice coming over the police dispatcher's receiver as clearly as if he had been there to hear it himself.
This is Unit 21. I've got visual contact. It's Steel, all right. He's not completely crazy. Christ, Jernigan's down.
The voice belonged to Rick Borodini. End of chapter.